This is Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
A window to the Latin universe.
Stanford, 90.1 FM.
Radio Atenea Americana.
This is
Atenea Americana.
Bilingual house of culture, on the air and online.
Radio
Atenea Americana.
Su casa de la cultura en la radio y online.
Para la radio 90.1 KCSU Stanford.
I am Isabel Jubes.
Isabel Jubes. Bienvenidos.
Atenea Americana.
Welcome. Bienvenidos.
From Stanford to the world.
Talking with the recognized scientist biologist Dr. Rodolfo Dirzo. He runs Dirzo Lab at Stanford University, where he had also been a professor, a researcher, and later the director of the Center of the Latin American Studies. He has led the center for several years until this spring of 2016. We had him before in some of our shows, where we talk about his significant research and some of his famous scientific publications. Today, we will be talking about his latest award, the Roland Prize, which he won because of his above and beyond efforts spreading scientific literacy on kids and youth. He had also pioneered hands-on educational and multicultural programs with students from K-12, but also with all levels of college education students, having done this in a national and international way. He will talk about these programs and about how they benefit not just the future generation of scientists, but also encourage basic scientific literacy in all the next generations. Stay with us to learn about the topics of research of this Stanford laboratory and the educational programs that Professor Dirzo undertakes to ensure a positive scientific communication with the public. Stay with us to learn about the topics of research of this Stanford laboratory and the educational programs that Professor Dirzo leads. Remember that this and all our shows are at stanfordhispanicbroadcasting.org, and that you may also find them in all the most popular podcast platforms.
Welcome again to our show here in Atenea Americana to Professor and longtime guest, Professor Dirzo from the Center of Latin American Studies and Dirzo Lab here at Stanford. Mm-hmm. Welcome, and also congratulations for your latest award, the Ronald Prize.
Thank you so very much. Delighted to be with you once again, and happy to share with your audience what we're doing recently.
Yes, last time, I just checked, it was a long time ago, too long. We talked a little bit about a very successful article you had, just that that program, I think we just made it in Spanish, about defaunation.
Yes.
And about how it affects ecology and life in all natural places right now.
Yes.
How the disappearance of one species is, you know, is the snowball that will grow and affect everything.
Would you like to teach a class on that? Would you like to be a teacher or professor on that?
Oh, I love that topic.
Yes. You explained it perfectly.
Oh, thank you. Mm. And then you won also this prize, which is also a little bit about all the efforts you have been made, including local populations here.
Yes.
And in other places, educating and retrofeeding all these university studies with local people.
Right. Yeah. So that's the reason for the recognition, the Roland Prize, which is a wonderful thing. It's a program that the university runs to recognize the efforts of people who want to do something in terms of service to the communities, outside the university. I mean, obviously, everybody expects for you to be a good teacher, a good professor, a good instructor, a good researcher. But this, and this is, you know, the sort of the normal expectation for you to be doing here at Stanford as a professor, as faculty. But this Roland Prize actually recognizes the efforts that people might do in terms of engaging with communities outside the university. And the type of science that I do, deforestation, global change, ecological relationships between plants and animals, the ecology and evolution of the ecosystems of the plants and animals in the ecosystems, my passion is to not only do my research on that, but also to share that with people. And I have been engaged in a number of programs to try and do that precisely. And in terms of either bringing students to the university or us meaning my students and myself, going out to the different schools or communities here to share that kind of knowledge. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the fact that we are losing animals at an incredible rate, say in the order of millions of animals per locality. Mm-hmm. For example, we estimate in the Amazon probably 23 million animals are killed per year in the Amazon, mm-hmm. just in the Brazilian Amazon, and so on and so forth. And what is the significance of that for the ecosystem functioning and also for society? You know, if you don't have animals, then, for example, if you don't have the predators, then you will have an explosion of the herbivores. And if the herbivores explode, then you will not have regeneration of the forest because of an overgrazing. Or if you lose the animals that pollinate the plants that are relevant for our crop production and things like that. Mm-hmm. So all of those scientific issues that might sound very esoteric or very difficult very restricted to the scientific community, the plan is to actually bring all of those things and share with the community via these different programs that we have, which, by the way, are pretty much directed to paying attention to underserved communities in the Bay Area and also in other parts of the world. And we will talk about that, I imagine.
Yes. So let's start with the underserved population here. And community here.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's kind of an ironical situation that in this fantastic area of the Silicon Valley, where Stanford University is, where NASA is, where Google is, all of these fantastic high-tech companies and amazing intellectual entities such as Stanford University or Berkeley and some others, you know, we have still some communities that are very much limited in terms of the opportunities to have access to all of this technology or to the knowledge that is sort of underlies all of these institutions and technological sites. So the idea of these programs with underserved communities is to provide them with opportunities for them to see a number of things. Number one, what is this business of STEM, science, mm-hmm. technology, engineering, and mathematics? Mm-hmm. Why is that fascinating as an endeavor of sort of human intellect? But also, why is that important for society as a whole? So the idea is to expose all of these things that are limited in their dissemination with different communities to precisely do that, mm-hmm. to bring them or to facilitate for them to get to know all of these things that are going on in the sciences, in the technology, and engineering, and mathematics. And we do it either by bringing students from underserved communities. Here we're talking about, you know, Redwood City, East Palo Alto, some areas of San Jose as well, mm-hmm. to bring them to the university to make sure that they actually come into the boundaries of the university and take advantage of the fantastic facilities that we have here, not only physical but also intellectual. And in some other cases, we actually go to their own entities. Our Redwood City program, which is called REAL, mm-hmm. Which means Redwood Environmental Leadership Academy of Leadership, we go on Fridays to the school to try and bring in the sciences, the knowledge, and the understanding of issues, mm-hmm. about ecology and environment to the schools, to the communities. And so, as I said, in some cases we go to the schools, in some other cases we bring the students here. Mm-hmm. And for all of those things, we engage in partnerships, right? I mean, for one thing, the schools are our most direct partner, because we wouldn't be able to do any of these activities if we had not partnered with the schools, if we had not been partnering with the schools. So schools in San Jose, schools in Redwood City, in East Palo Alto, they have to trust us. Mm-hmm. They have to be willing to work with us, and then they need to help us as well. Mm-hmm. For every single program, yeah. Not only do we bring the kids, but we also have the teachers being involved in the programs, either because they come as chaperones or because they help us, you know, with the management of the big groups that we have. Mm-hmm. These groups can be in the order of 25 students, depending on the group. In some other cases, there are smaller groups. But even so, we want to make sure that also the teachers and parents are part of the program as well.
Mm-hmm. And then you bring these kids and give them, you know, the basic understanding of the scientific method,
yes,
the basic understanding of what science or math and how they can apply to the life and how involves their reality.
Right. So, yeah, we do that. Again, talking about the partnerships, for example, in the case of the STEM for Latina Girls, that program, our partners are multiple, not only the schools, but also, in this particular case, the Mexican consulate. Mm-hmm. So they help us with a number of logistics, the most important of which is that they facilitate the transportation of the girls to the university or to the other sites that we go and visit for the series, which we do every Tuesday afternoon. So, you know, we need to have another partner that will help us with that. In addition to that, in this example, the Mexican consulate, they go to the schools in San Jose and they find the schools and they sort of organize the interaction with the principals and with the teachers, and they select the students to bring and participate in this program. So all of that is taken care of by the Mexican consulate in interaction with schools. Once the kids are selected and they're going to be brought here to the university, then we take over. We do the sort of the cultural and scientific and technical aspects of the thing, including the food that the kids get when they come here, mm-hmm. to make sure that, you know, they don't spend a whole day with no nourishment, because they really need to be paid attention on that regard too. But at any rate, it's a partnership that involves several members of the interaction to be able to produce this or to provide these services to the community.
And today we are talking with Professor Rodolfo Dirso from Dirso Labs and the Center of Latin American Studies at Stanford University. Stay with us to listen about his research and the efforts for scientific literacy at all levels. And remember that this and all our shows are at stanfordhispanicpodcasting.org. And that you may listen to this and other shows in the most common podcast platforms online. And remember to follow us in the social networking sites.
You were telling me a little bit about some of the scientific knowledge they get here, like the experimentation with the ecology problem and the forest and the geology part.
Exactly.
One of many.
Yeah, well, you see, our perspective is that it is much better, it's much more attractive for students, especially for young students, to engage in the understanding of science if they engage themselves in activities. Mm-hmm. So essentially our programs are programs that have this mantra, which is learning by doing. Mm-hmm. And so the example that we were talking about is, for example, in the area of ecology, a significant issue that we have is the lack of regeneration of the native forest, the iconic, emblematic oak woodlands that we have in California. Well, now we see a very serious problematic with that, because we see many old legendary trees that are standing there. But, you know, when those trees die as a natural process, we need to have the regeneration. We need to have the juvenile and the baby trees to regenerate the population, to sort of recruit into the population. We're noticing that is a limiting factor nowadays. Many of our forests, even in the biological preserve of the university, Jasper Ridge, the forest, the oak woodland regeneration is very limited. And so we have hypotheses to what that might be happening. One of the hypotheses is that in the absence of the big predators, mountain lions, bears that used to be present, completely eradicated, extinct locally, then the animals that are the prey of those animals are becoming much more abundant, particularly deer. And I'm sure that would be the case also of some rodents, rats, and some others. But let's consider the case of deer. In the absence of the predators, or maybe other reasons, then the population of deer is increasing quite dramatically, actually. So in the Jasper Ridge Biological Preserve, one of the consequences we suspect of not having deer is that this hyperabundance of these animals increases the grazing, the trampling, and the mortality of the baby oak trees. Mm-hmm. So how do you test that hypothesis, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's a problem that we present to the girls in the program. Okay, we have this limitation, and you see, you show them, look at this landscape. You see the big trees, but you don't see the baby trees. So you begin to ask the questions, why would that be? And so we talk about the mountain lions, then we talk about the deer. Okay, how can we investigate that? So we take them to an area that we have an experiment, an ongoing experiment, in which we have exclosures to prevent deer from going to particular areas of the forest compared to areas in which the deer can go. And so the kids, the girls, are asked to actually go to those experimental plots and count the number of baby trees in the two conditions where the deer are prevented from going and in areas where the deer are hyperabundant. Mm-hmm. So they get the data, they do the counting, and then we come back to the lab and then we do sort of the statistics, right? So we calculate the actual number inside and outside with different replication. Mm-hmm. So the concept of replication, the concept of averages, mm-hmm. and the conclusions that you get from looking at the numbers. Yeah. So then we debate in the classroom, mm-hmm. to what extent the hypothesis that we have is actually true, as supported by, is actually supported by the numbers or not, mm-hmm. right? And then we debate about that. And so you can see that the whole scientific process is actually, even without them noticing, mm-hmm. you know, sort of in their minds, they are seeing the scientific yeah. process. You have a problem, you have a hypothesis, you have a question that you want to address. Here's a hypothesis, what you would imagine is happening, mm-hmm. and then you do something in mm-hmm. real life to measure, to take data and then come back and look at the data and debate, and yeah. what was the conclusion, what is the discussion. So that's beautiful to see the whole process with these little girls being sort of the protagonists of the experiment.
Yes, definitely will engrave in their minds for a long time.
So we hope, yeah.
And they will be very excited and talk about that, and hopefully...
Exactly. Yeah. You know, they might talk to the parents or friends in the school or at home, mm-hmm. or the brothers and sisters, you know, what is it that they did today, what they learned today. And, you know, little by little, probably, you know, by serving as our ambassadors, mm-hmm. they might be spreading the word of the beauty and the importance of science for mm-hmm. society at large.
Thank you for listening to Atenea Americana, your house of culture in the radio and online. In this bilingual show, I bring you every week 1 hour in English and 1 hour in Spanish, opening a window to the cultural Hispanic world. You can hear in the intro and at the final of the show, as well as right now, music from the legend of Latin jazz, Oscar Hernandez. This and all my shows are in StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org, where I wait for your comments. I invite you to be part of this. And today, we are talking with Professor Rodolfo Dirso from Dirso Labs and the Center of Latin American Studies at Stanford University.
Yes, and you also put this programs in other localities, the multicultural universities that
well.
Are in Mexico
yeah.
or in other places.
Yeah, so, you know, taking advantage of the fact that that my lab, mm-hmm. the students in my lab and I do research in other parts of the world, mostly Latin America, but other parts of the world, including Africa. So the sites that we have as study sites where we're doing our research programs, we make a point of saving some days of our programs when we go and do research to engage in activities that have to do, again, with dissemination and engagement and outreach with the local communities. Mm-hmm. And again, it could be just as we do it up here in Northern California, we could either bring the local teachers in the rural schools or the local students in those rural schools to the sites where I do the research. Luckily, in most of the sites where I do the research, there is a physical infrastructure. For example, in Veracruz, we have the National University with a field station, beautifully equipped with, you know, classrooms, library, laboratories, and so on and so forth. Well, in those cases, we bring the kids or the teachers to the field stations of the entities where we do our research, mm-hmm. or some other times we, the students and I, go to the schools to teach some classes. So when we want to reach a larger audience, we go to the schools and larger number of teachers and so on. So we do a combination of different things.
And
so
you bring bilingual students with you and
yes,
translators?
And translators. And you know, because nowadays the language of the sciences is very much English, mm-hmm. and so we bring students who can help the local students. students or the local teachers to use the terminology in English, what is equivalent in Spanish, for them to also be able to read the books, to use their manuals to identify plants and animals in their respective sites. Most of these manuals are written in English, so we want to contribute also by, you know, sort of sharing with them what is the terminology and the terms and the ways of reading these manuals in English for them to be able to use in their own activities. By the way, so this is something that we have not talked about, but can I really very quickly interrupt and tell you about this other new course that I'm teaching in Stanford in spring? This is something within of a service within the community in Stanford. It's called Spanish in Science, Science in Spanish. And the idea of this course, this is a course for undergrads, or anybody can take it, but so far it has been mostly undergrads who are interested. This is a course in which I teach the language, the Spanish language, but as it is applied to the sciences. That emerged as an interest that I have seen not only in my students in my own lab but in other laboratories as well, that many students want to go and do research or teaching in Latin America. And so, I mean, they will engage in their normal teaching or learning the Spanish, but in this particular case, they learn the scientific language of the Spanish. So I do a number of tricks for us to do that. For example, I do a number of presentations with a PowerPoint written in Spanish for them to see how the words are written, and then I do the presentations in Spanish. So they will connect how it's written and how it sounds. And then I bring a number of articles, scientific articles, in Spanish for us to discuss, having read the articles in Spanish. And then I force them a little bit to also introduce themselves and speak a little in Spanish, all of this in scientific terminology. So that's another kind of thing. This is mostly to serve the community within Stanford, but it just occurred to me to mention it because, you know, nowadays Spanish is becoming such an important language globally, and especially when you want to do things in Latin America, in the arts, in the culture, or in the sciences, getting to know the appropriate language for those particular domains is important. So I'm doing this class now.
And the big rainforests are also in places where they speak Spanish.
Yes, yes. Although in some other cases, there are places where they also speak some indigenous languages. Spanish is in Latin America, with the exception of Brazil, in which they speak Portuguese. Spanish is a very common language in those places where the rainforest ecosystems are.
And I find a lot of these terms that come from Latin is a matter of, because I learned them the other way around, from Spanish to English, is to you see how they are pronounced and what part you keep from the Latin part to the English.
Exactly. And that becomes a very interesting and tricky part, actually, because, you know, in Spanish we tend to keep the pronunciation as it is in Latin. In English it's very different. And so, you know, if they don't see the pronunciation, how it is different in Spanish as in English, even though it might come from the Latin, which should be a root that we should understand easier, the pronunciation is very different in English as it is in Spanish. In Spanish, it's much closer to the Latin itself. But anyway, so that's again with the purpose of, you know, teaching and engaging Latin America in all of this. But really, the main purpose is to with this. With these activities of outreach and education, is to make sure that these communities have access to what is the science, the beauty of the sciences, and the significance of that for their personal lives and also for society as a whole.
Yeah, and to make science as a universal language for everybody.
Yeah.
Which will be so important now and in the future with all the climate change and all the
happening. With the climate change, which is, you know, as I think we have said in one of these programs before, certainly I think we talked about that in the Anthropocene, climate change being a very important global environmental change, perhaps the most sexy of them all, because everybody sort of talks about it, even though some sects of society don't even believe that there's such a thing. but it's not the only global change. So there's climate change and there is land use change, meaning habitat destruction, deforestation, fragmentation, those kinds of things. Another very serious global environmental change is pollutants, contaminants, which, you know, some of them are in record levels and continue to increase.
Change of acidity of the water.
Yeah, and oceans, ocean acidification. I mean, it's not only the temperature, but it's also the acidity. certification. Another problem that we tend to overlook, but it's really very serious, is the question of invasion of species that don't belong, so to speak. Yes. You know, human activities are moving rats, plants, grasses, weeds, all over the planet. And so the ecosystems are having new inputs of biological components that were not present there. In some cases, that becomes a major, major tragedy. Well, just think of the rats in islands, you know, basically decimated native plants and animals and destroyed many ecosystems. Anyway, so that's another problem. Yeah. But the crucial issue, I think, from the scientific point of view is nowadays is that we need, as a scientist, to understand that all of these factors do not operate by themselves in isolation, but rather they operate in complex ways, they interact in complex ways. So land use change combines with climate change, acidification, which is in some sense of some kind of pollution, combines with increased temperatures in the ocean. Erosion, because of the deforestation in the land, brings sediments to the shores. The use of pesticides or even the use of fertilizers in agricultural fields, particularly nitrogen, when the runoff goes to the rivers, the creeks and the rivers, and eventually ends up in the ocean, then you have these called dead zones, areas that they accumulate so much in terms of nutrients that create a bloom of algae that then sort of kill the shores, the coastal areas, and so on. So all of these very complex combinations of the different factors, in addition to climate change, these are the ones that I just mentioned, come into play now to create a very challenging situation. First of all, to understand scientifically, and second, for scientists to be able to communicate to everybody, including the policymakers, what is at stake if we don't pay attention to the combined effect of all of these drivers.
And today, we are talking with Professor Rodolfo Dirso from Dirso Labs and the Center of Latin American Studies at Stanford University.
And with this basic scientific literacy for people, you can get into these conversations like when people, famous cases, when they think that they can fix a problem bringing a species from somewhere else and then obviously
creating a major problem
and then bring another different problem. Now we don't have the algae because this fish ate the algae, but now this fish doesn't have a predator and kill the other ones, and
exactly
all this stuff.
Sometimes these things cascade all the way up to to the loss of major ecosystems or to the proliferation of some elements of the ecosystems that become a problem, right?
But if everybody has a basic knowledge of what is happening, they won't jump the gun and bring a different animal to a place where it doesn't belong.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. I mean, it's not that we pretend in our programs to make sure that everybody becomes a scientist. It would be great, but I don't think we need a world dominated, in which all the people are scientists. We need the artists, we need the sociologists, we need the historians, and we need the communicators, we need the different specialties, but we do need science to be one of the elements of the culture of people, as you said, literacy, for people to be literate in science generally. I mean, not only because we want for them to be scientists, but because, we have to make decisions that have to do with science. And we can think of a range of situations in which scientific literacy is really very important. You know, for decisions such as, for example, don't bring any exotic species from another place to California because of the possible devastating effect that might have. If you have an understanding of the ecological consequence of that, you will not do that. But all the way up to things such as, fundamental and perhaps even trivial, but at the same time fundamental, such as when the time comes for you to elect your officials, right? You might want to elect a person or a candidate that has an ecological or an environmental or sustainability agenda. But if you don't understand the issues yourself, very difficult it's going to be for you to select amongst the different candidates the one that might be more convenient from the point of view of these global environmental problems. Mm-hmm. So scientific literacy actually transcends many different arenas mm-hmm. and becomes a fundamental aspect of the culture of people, independently of the fact that they might not be scientists, yeah. which of course is not what is going to happen.
Yeah, but even applying, you know, basic of the scientific method, observing, understanding, thinking logically about something, trying math, involving math yeah. in some decisions, it might change your point of view.
And debating, debate based on facts, right? That's yes. kind of a crucial yes. thing. And another thing that is really very interesting in sort of in the sequence of events that you described in the scientific method, another thing that is very important in the scientific method is that the truth for us, the truth for science, is rarely argued to be the unique truth. Mm-hmm. We always are looking for alternative explanations to almost everything. So we question ourselves almost in everything. Mm-hmm. And so if the data do not match the predictions or the expectations, then we revisit other ideas. And I think that question, you know, being open to different perspectives and different ideas that might explain things better, which is a fundamental aspect of the scientific method, is really, really very important for society. Yeah. We need to be open to different opinions, and we need to be convinced when the evidence is convincing. But if the evidence is not convincing, we should always look for different answers and different perspectives yeah. until we come to what seems to be the most appropriate explanation for things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And as you say that we are approaching and you are approaching all the minorities in the
yes.
state that are not minority anymore. They are actually
right.
a big part, big they chunk of the society.
And they are increasing in population size.
Yes,
yeah.
And they are the future. Like
exactly.
what used to be minorities now are half of California and pretty much will be 75% of California.
Right.
Well, maybe a 20% of the country, and they will grow to 30-something percent.
Yeah.
So if we don't educate this base,
exactly.
what is the future for us, for our economy, for the world?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, given this demographic transitions that we see, you know, many young people being from those communities, particularly in the Serb communities, we need to make sure that we pay attention to the education of those and the provision of opportunities to those communities because, I mean, it's so fundamental for the well-being of the country, of the nation, that these communities are paid attention to because in a few years, I mean, we're not talking about centuries, we're talking about just a few decades,
mm-hmm.
a few years, all of these people, all of these persons are going to be, you know, the major proportion of the population in the labor force and in the decision-making force. So
mm-hmm.
education is really, really essential. Not to pay attention to these communities is a very myopic mm-hmm. perspective going forward.
Yes.
And it's so crucial, you know, for the benefit of the society. That said, we are really in a very challenging situation in the country nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
I have participated in a number of panels and analysis of the sort of the scientific education in the country. The country used to be rated as one of the top a few years ago, no longer the case. So we
mm-hmm.
really need to go back and pay attention to the scientific education of the young people in the country
yes.
because of the reasons that we have mentioned. But, you know, that might sort of the decline in the interest in science might have to do with things that we ourselves in our educational systems have been responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
This usual old traditional idea of memorizing
yes.
just to pass the exam is something so archaic that
yes.
we need to find different ways of engaging people, of making them excited about the scientific method, the scientific discoveries, the beauty of the science and the significance of that for society,
mm-hmm.
that we need to make sure that our educational programs, protocols, are much more engaging and not the usual thing that used to be in the past.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in a typical exam, you know, you're forced to study, you memorize, and then a few days later, everything has gone. But if you do a thing that is very much engaging and you do hands-on activities, learning by doing,
mm-hmm.
chances are that you're going to retain the concepts. I mean, you might not have to memorize the details. Nowadays, with so much communication, with so much internet information available,
yeah.
I mean, the details you can be obtained, but sort of the general principles, the general concepts, this is exactly what the scientific education should be doing
Exactly. Now with the internet, with the computer, you don't have to know all the words because you can have them in the computer. But if you have the understanding of the concept and the depthness of what you're talking about.
Exactly. So that means a sort of a revolutionary ways of doing education and engaging people, particularly the young people and the underserved communities, to become part of the community that is going to be the sort of the majority in a few years' time.
Yes, and it is, in the Bay Area, at least I know for my kids' school, that there are some changes and big movements of people doing hands-on education that they recognize if you make the kids touch, smell, interact with something, it will stay in their minds different
very
than if they just read it in an article.
Very much so. And also if they see their learning in the context of things that are related to them, right? I mean, the case that we talked about, the lack of regeneration of the oak woodlands in California, is something so vivid that, you know, when the kids do an experiment or study on ecology in relation to that problem, the concept of the food chain, you know, the predators not being present and increasing of the prey and then affecting the vegetation, the concept might be there much easier if they actually did something in relation to that than if they just had to memorize it. The food chain has three trophic levels. First level is the primary producer. I mean, all of those things that are, you don't have to memorize all of those details, but you have to understand the principle and the concepts, especially if you are related to those problems that you see in your neighborhood or in your area, eventually in the world, right?
Yes, and the raptors have also disappeared.
Oh my goodness, that's a very serious problem. And in California, you know, we have done some things, but imagine other parts of the planet, Africa, for example, particularly the use of pesticides, it has become a very serious problem. The pesticides, because the pesticides accumulate in the food chain. So, you know, imagine the raptors that come to the carcass of a zebra that died or got killed. All of those pesticides that came from the plants to the animals to the zebras and then the predators and the raptors, all of that accumulation, the raptors. And imagine a world without these animals that play a fundamental role in decomposing all of these carcasses and all of these materials that are staying there if we lose the raptors.
And then you have a overpopulation, not just of deer, but I was thinking when you were talking before about squirrels and squirrels going crazy in the area.
Increasing in numbers, because of the lack of their biological controls as well.
Yeah.
But the question that you brought up, the raptors is a very tricky one, especially in some parts of the world. Africa is really a very dramatic situation nowadays with the raptors.
Talking with Professor Rodolfo Dirso from Dirso Labs and the Center of Latin American Studies at Stanford University. Stay with us to listen about his research and the efforts for scientific literacy at all levels. And remember that this and all our shows are at stanfordhispanicbroadcasting.org. And that you may listen to these and other shows in the most common podcast platforms online. And remember to follow us in the social networking sites.
So many interesting problems, interesting and at the same time challenging problems that we need. We need communication and we need young people to become engaged in addressing these issues going forward.
All these programs that you are involved, that Stanford is involved and your lab is involved, you have places where people can go and check them out. If there is another community in the Bay Area that will be interested in getting contact with you guys.
Yes, I will not be able to memorize the websites, but anybody can get in touch with me in the Dirso Lab website of the university. If anybody goes into Stanford.
Yeah, we have the links.
And you can provide the links as well. Yeah, so you can be the best vehicle to connect people, and we'll be more than happy to advise or to comment or to go to schools and talk to the teachers or go to the schools and talk to the kids anytime. This is our passion in addition to doing the scientific research.
Great. And so I will knock your door for I already have a few ideas.
Anytime.
Sure. Well, of course, thank you. It has been an honor to have you here again, and I hope to keep you in the, you know, roller.
Okay, yeah.
And of course, and now you are retiring from your role in the Center of Latin American Studies.
But my lab is going to be as active as always, perhaps with a little bit more time on my part to be able to do all of these things that I've been doing in my science.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And this was Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
Stanford, 90.1 FM.
Radio Atenea Americana.
A window to the Latin universe.
This is
Radio
Atenea Americana.
Bilingual house of culture on the air and online.
Su casa de la cultura en la radio y online.
Para la radio 90.1 KCSU Stanford.
I am Isabel Jubes.
Isabel Jubes. Vuelve pronto.
Atenea Americana.
From Stanford to the world.
Remember to come back soon.
Ciao.
See you later.